From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Take 2, May Martinez. California Senator Kamala Harris will be Joe Biden's running mate. She's the first woman of color to ever be on a major political party's presidential ticket. We'll hear what her selection does to shape the race to the White House. Plus, there will be no USC-UCLA sports rivalry this fall as the Pac-12 conference has postponed the fall schedule, but will football be the only sport to survive in January? It's ahead on Take 2. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take 2. I'm Amy Martinez. Thanks for joining us on this very busy Tuesday. A lot of big news. Been breaking all day, so let's dive right in. In just a few minutes, we're going to hear about the Pac-12's decision to cancel all fall sports. But first, we're going to get into something that's really top of mind for all Californians right now. Just minutes ago, presumptive nominee, Democratic nominee Joe Biden announced that California Senator Kamala Harris is his pick for his vice presidential running mate. And it comes after months of speculation. Here was Joe Biden's tweet. Happened around 1:17 today. I have the great honor to announce that I've picked Kamala Harris, a fearless fighter for the little guy and one of the country's finest public servants, as my running mate. And Kamala Harris, not that long ago, a few minutes ago, just tweeted out, "Joe Biden can unify the American people because he spent his life fighting for us. And as president, he'll build an America that lives up to our ideals. I am honored to join him as our party nominee for vice president and do what it takes to make him our commander in chief." We have two people that are going to be here with us to talk about it. Anja Marie Hancock Alfaro is chair of the Department of Political Science and International Relations at USC, and Christina Bellantoni is the former assistant managing editor for the LA Times, now the director of USC's Annenberg Media Center. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. A big day for California. Anja Marie, let's start with you. Biden has embraced a former rival in some ways. He's also done what was widely expected, choose a woman of color. What are your first reactions to the choice?
You know, my first reaction was this was not just the smart choice, but also the safest choice Biden could have made. I think they share such simpatico with regard to their ideology, their pragmatism, and frankly, some of their moderation. I would say that Kamala Harris is probably one of the most moderates of the progressives in California.
And do you think that would reunite? Is that the thinking, to unite the Democratic Party, which seems to be split ideologically in some ways?
I think that that was absolutely part of the calculation, right? So even though there have been criticisms, and I think there are plenty that have kind of come out about Harris over the past few months, and the Biden campaign wanted to logically wait and see what happened with some of those, if any of them stuck. I think the idea here is that she is more moderate than someone like an Elizabeth Warren, but she is more progressive than Joe Biden himself.
Christina, what about you? What were you thinking when you heard the news?
You know, the first thing I thought of was covering the 2008 campaign and when Biden got himself into a lot of trouble by saying something, you know, pretty disrespectful about then Senator Barack Obama, his colleague. You know, he called him both clean and articulate. And Barack Obama forgave him, right? Barack Obama ended up embracing him and trusting him and having him join the ticket. And this kind of feels like that. I mean, that's, you're going to see lots of clips replayed of Harris going after Biden so sharply at that debate. But at the same time, that was what her job was, right? You try to take down your rivals and the front runners. And she proved herself as someone who is unafraid and unflinching, which is a quality that will probably be pretty valuable in the rest of this rough and tumble campaign where who the heck knows what's going to happen and how it's all going to go. And she's also been extremely steady on her feet over the course of her political career, you know, both here in California and since going to Washington as a U.S. senator. So, yeah, I mean, and all the things that Anja Marie said are 100% true. She is a good choice. She is extremely capable. She's extremely intelligent. And, you know, she's not going to back down against what we know will be, you know, probably the worst attacks to ever come against anybody, because that's just the moment we're in. Just like it'll be the most expensive campaign in history, it'll be the nastiest campaign in history.
And Christina, on that moment where Joe Biden and Kamala Harris kind of went at each other, it was mostly Kamala Harris discussing Biden's record on busing in the Senate a few years ago. But there was a story that came out in Politico on, I think, on the 27th of last month. The headline was, "She Had No Remorse, Why Kamala Harris Is in a Lock for VP." And in that story in Politico, it says that Senator Chris Dodd, who was a member of Biden's vice presidential search committee, asked Harris about that exact moment. It was termed as an ambush on Biden in the Politico story, and that he was stunned because she showed no remorse. So I'm wondering how much of this decision was Biden saying, Christina, look, I'm the president, or at least I'm the president, I'm the one that wants to be president. I make the final call on this.
Obviously, he makes the final call. I think, you know, I covered Dodd for many years, and I've covered his presidential bid, which was the same year Biden ran in 2008 as well against Obama. And you know, he is entitled to his role on that campaign, but it is Biden's decision. And I think that he said that he went by the same credo that Obama went by, which is pick somebody who you know can do the job of president, someone who you want to be your last decision maker in the room alongside you, someone that you can trust. And for whether that happened at the beginning or that developed over the course of the selection process, he must feel that way. Certainly, it's also tactically smart. She's somebody that can help excite the base. She's somebody that can help him raise money. She's proved to be a capable fundraiser. She's from a huge state. Not that state is a swing state, but it will deliver a lot of raw numbers and support and money and I think energy that some of the other people on his shortlist wouldn't necessarily be as likely to deliver.
Now, for people who are just starting to get to know Senator Kamala Harris, Christina, what do you think people need to know about her background and where she's coming from?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting with like the label, because I would put her on the left, even though, yes, certainly some of the policies that she's embraced, you know, as Attorney General and over the course of the campaign have been more moderate. And she did get into some trouble for not really taking a strong position on healthcare, which at the beginning of this primary campaign was the top issue, and she didn't handle that very well. But her record in California has been extremely interesting. She won decisively over a fellow Democrat, same year that Donald Trump was elected, in a campaign that was pretty quiet. You know, they had a couple meetings, you know, debates, forums, whatever you call them, that were tame, went well, and she was able to do what she wanted to do without needing the press very much, which, you know, as somebody that was running politics at the LA Times at the time, was extremely irritating. But she's exceedingly careful as a politician, which I think is a good counterbalance to Joe Biden, who is not. I've known him my entire career, and that is not something I would say about him. He can be very, very free and freewheeling, and that is not necessarily a great candidate quality. And then in addition to that, you know, as Attorney General, she was, you know, key ally of Jerry Brown's and, you know, did what she needed to do at a time when they were getting a little bit tougher on some issues of law and order. But at the same time, the state was going through, you know, what we've seen happen in the aftermath, really, of the Trayvon Martin shooting and ever since, and this current Black Lives Matter movement, where she had to deal with many police shootings and looking at the issue of body cameras and things like that. And it's a mixed record. Not everybody's going to be happy with it. It is going to get more scrutiny. And I would highly recommend people go read the LA Times coverage of this. It's very comprehensive and detailed, kind of looking at all the different decisions she had to make. And then as district attorney in San Francisco is the same thing. But she has, over the course of those roles, really been front and center, able to handle a lot of scrutiny, really pretty tested. There doesn't, you know, everybody that ever looked for a bunch of skeletons in her closet never found them. Doesn't mean there aren't any, but that's something that I'm sure appealed to the campaign as well. And, you know, that record will get a tough look, especially at this moment in America.
Talking to Christina Bellantoni, former assistant managing editor for the LA Times, now the director of USC's Annenberg Media Center, and Anjmarie Hancock-Alfaro, chair of the Department of Political Science and International Relations at USC. Anjmarie, as mentioned, Senator Harris ran a presidential campaign of her own that did not work out. And one of the major criticisms she faced was that she played it too safe, didn't really make her stance known on important issues such as, say, health care. When you look at Kamala Harris's record, what are some question marks that still stand out to you?
Well, I think Christina is right. It's not to say that there aren't any, you know, skeletons in the closet, but there will be some definite digging to see if, you know, anything is going to come out. And the main question has been what will stick, of course, you know, because again, having run her own presidential campaign, I think Biden and the Biden campaign were smart to see that as a plus, in the sense of she's already been on the road. She's already had some vetting, right? So this kind of raises her value as opposed to someone like a Stacey Abrams or a Karen Bass, you know, who as strong and qualified as they both are, were not kind of time tested in the way a presidential campaign can really test you. I think in terms of one question I still have that I think, again, we will see what happens in the general campaign, is that her record as a prosecutor was something that she took a hit for during the presidential debates. I mean, I think everybody agreed that, you know, Tulsi Gabbard's best moment running for president was when she had, you know, quite a zinger against Senator Harris in one of the debates. And so given what's happened just in the past few months with George Floyd and the reemergence of Black Lives Matter, you know, I think, you know, there were folks who really think that her career as a prosecutor would be a weight, something that would weigh her down. And so I think that's certainly one narrative around it. But to the suburban white women and the moms who are both pro Black Lives Matter, as well as pro Me Too from a couple of years ago, you know, Kamala Harris also cleared the backlog of rape kits when she was serving as attorney general, a race that she won by less than 100,000 votes in the state of California. So it'll be interesting to me to see which of those narratives wins out, right? Is she too conservative on criminal justice reform? Or is she the person who's going to stand up for crime victims, you know, and then convert voters for Joe Biden, who don't necessarily look like her, but share some of her same values?
Christina, we are already seeing some positive response from California lawmakers. Congressman Adam Schiff tweeted this, quote, when Barack Obama picked Joe Biden as VP in 2008, he hit a home run. Well, Joe Biden picking Kamala Harris is a grand slam. Kamala is a brilliant and dedicated public servant. California has been lucky to have her as senator, and now the nation will be lucky to have her as VP. What would a Kamala Harris vice presidency mean for California, Christina?
And I like thinking of it as, what does Kamala Harris vice presidency, what does California mean for the nation, right? You know, where I'm extremely proud to live in the best state anywhere. And I think that we are a place that really always has been a leader, always has been forward thinking, has progressive policies in a way that I personally appreciate, having grown up here as well. And I like that. I like bringing some California flair to the ticket and or the White House if that were to happen. And, you know, California will be just fine without her if she is elected, and she will be just fine if they lose, right? She will continue to be popular here and be able to keep her Senate seat, I think, for as long as she wants it. But if she is elected, then there will be a vacancy, and that means Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom gets to pick somebody, and that's something that every governor really likes to have. In fact, one governor in Illinois went to jail because he said it was such a great opportunity to name a replacement. And that's going to be something that, including the congressman you just quoted, you know, is going to be very interested in. A lot of ambitious members of the California delegation are hoping to move up. This is a good way to do it, to get that appointment. And then the person would likely run for the seat when it ends up on the ballot. Not to mention Dianne Feinstein could retire at any point, decide not to seek re-election when her term is up. So I think we're going to see a real generational shift in California over the next few years, and potentially even further. But, you know, it's something California can be proud to see it represented. It means they'll have a, you know, if it were a real convention, they would have a great in-person, you know, seat to view the stage. Now, because it's virtual, I don't know if that means you have like a better view on your Zoom room or what, but, you know, I think California will get some good treatment out of it, which is great.
I mean, if I know my U.S. history correctly, Christina, I think the last California politician to be in the White House, either as VP or president, was Ronald Reagan.
That's correct.
Yeah, that would be the one.
Yeah.
Anj Marie, one thing, obviously, conversations about race and policing have gained a lot of national attention in recent months. Do you think that adding Kamala Harris to the ticket will motivate voters of color, especially Black voters in key states like, say, South Carolina, to participate in the election?
Yeah, I think I do. You know, in terms of what Harris brings to the table, you know, I know there was a lot of kind of, you know, navel gazing around whether or not Harris would bring more Black voters or Abrams or Bass, you know, who or Val Demings, who would actually bring more Black voters. I think Black voters are highly motivated to participate in this election. I think there are pockets of those voters who are African-American who need to kind of be turned out and mobilized. And so again, I think what the campaign does in terms of narratives, particularly around her prosecutorial record, are gonna motivate or demobilize those younger Black voters who maybe weren't quite on board with Harris the way they would have been with somebody like Elizabeth Warren, for example, ironically. But I think the other thing that Kamala Harris brings to the table that is distinct is that she has a strong bond also because she comes from California, to Christina's point, with Latinx voters. So she was supported by several prominent Latinx elected officials here in the state of California, including Mayor Robert Garcia of Long Beach and other folks. And so I think, you know, again, the idea that Senator Harris is just going to mobilize Black voters really underestimates her potential appeal to voters of color, because in addition to being the first Black woman on a ticket, she will also be the first South Asian woman on a ticket. And she's always been very open, especially about having been raised by her mother, who was of South Asian descent, and how much that influenced who she is as a person today.
And in case you both are wondering, President Donald Trump tweeted about 40 minutes ago, he tweeted a video of Kamala Harris attacking Joe Biden in that debate not so long ago. So the race is on, I guess. It's going to be one that I think is going to get probably a little bit dirty, but also probably entertaining as well. Anja Marie Hancock Alfaro is chair of the Department of Political Science and International Relations at USC. Christina Bellantoni is the former assistant managing editor for the LA Times, now the director of USC's Annenberg Media Center. Anja Marie, Christina, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
All right, All Things Considered is going to start early today. It's going to start at 3 o'clock with Nick Roman covering the big news of the day. Kamala Harris, California senator, selected as Joe Biden's running mate for this election. So make sure you're tuned in. All Things Considered, starting at 3 o'clock today, starting a little bit early. Coming up, the Pac-12 had decided to cancel football this fall, but will all the sports make it back when they try to play in the spring? That's coming up when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. I'm E. Martinez. Los Angeles is home to more charter schools than any other city in the nation. An estimated 118,000 children attend charters in LA. Charter schools in Los Angeles are complaining that local officials' plans to implement a new law, part of Assembly Bill 1505, could put their schools at risk. With us here to break down its potential impact is Kyle Stokes, KPCC's education reporter. Welcome back, Kyle.
Hi, A.
All right, so let's start off with some of Charter School 101. Kyle, just so everyone's on the same page here, for anyone who does not know, can you explain the difference between a charter school and a public school?
Yeah, so the difference between a charter school and a district-run school is that both of those receive public funding to operate, but district schools are overseen by the school board. A charter school is run by a nonprofit group, by an independent organization that will go to a school board and they'll say, hey, we want to open up a school and use public money to do it. And so they need the permission of what's called an authorizer, a local school board, to open that school in the first first place. Now, this obviously, the reason that they're so controversial is because when you open up a charter school and then students that might have otherwise enrolled in the district enroll in a charter school, the state money goes to the charter school, not the district. So that's a reason why in Los Angeles, where there are more charter schools than any other single school district in the country, that this is such a, that charters are so controversial. But that law that you mentioned, AB 1505, is all about whether or not school districts can get that permission to, or whether charter schools rather can get that permission to open in the first place.
Now, when it comes to charter schools, I mean, we've seen a lot open up over the last few years, but they faced a lot of backlash too. What are some of the main criticisms of charter schools?
I mean, you hear a lot of different criticisms. It largely sort of revolves around that funding issue. But, you know, there are differences that I think rub people the wrong way. For example, charter schools are not unionized, and there are folks who believe that charter schools many charter schools are not unionized. There are some that are, but there are some within the teachers union movement that see charters as an effort to undermine the power of teachers unions. There have been, you know, sort of historical complaints about charter schools not serving students with disabilities. I think charter advocates would say that they've been trying to address those concerns. So the kind of differences all kind of come back to there's a spirit of competition that's fostered between district-run schools and charter schools, and it's set up by this sort of zero-sum funding game. And part of that, again, this new law that we're talking about, AB 1505, was crafted in the spirit of compromise to try and turn down the debate, get the two sides to make nice, and turn to advocating on mutually beneficial issues.
All right, so how exactly might the Assembly Bill 1505 and the new laws stemming from it impact charter schools?
So again, it's all about authorizing schools. It's about getting the permission that a charter school needs to open. And for a long time, you know, local school boards said that they, you know, complained that they didn't have enough power to say no to a charter school that is trying to open up, even if it would go against the best interest of the district, even if it would be against, you know, what, you know, the school board would consider in the community's best interest. They also sort of complained that even if there were a whole bunch of charter schools in one neighborhood, clustered within one neighborhood, that they wouldn't be able to, that they couldn't even block a charter school under those circumstances. I think charter school advocates would dispute this premise. I'll just put a pin in that. But basically what AB 1505 does is give these authorizers, give a local school board a lot more power to say no to a charter school. And that's kind of where the compromise headed, and what the compromise sort of entailed was the school, that a school district could, you know, basically have more power to say no to a new petition to open a charter. But in return, what charters got out of the deal was, you know, under the terms of the state law, existing schools with high test scores and strong academic and financial track records would have an easier time securing the permission that they need to get every couple of years to stay open, to have their charters renewed, is what it's called. That was the compromise that was reached. The question is whether that compromise can survive in the kind of rough and tumble world of LAUSD school board politics.
Because if it's a compromise, why is it causing such a stir from charter school proponents? I mean, if it's a compromise, after all.
Yeah. So this kind of goes back to the sort of those kind of rough and tumble charter school politics in Los Angeles. But, you know, it's sort of a wrinkle in how it's playing out in a place like Los Angeles, where there are a lot of hurdles to opening a charter school, and chief among them is facilities. And I think this is the prime concern that charter school advocates have about how LAUSD is implementing this new law, because a charter school has a really tough time finding facilities, they say. And basically, they think that the school district is using these facilities difficulties against them. You know, there is a law that allows charter schools to claim space on an LAUSD campus. It's called Prop 39 is the name of the law. The practice is known as co-location. So you have, you know, two publicly funded schools sharing the same campus. And these arrangements, I think it's fair to say that nobody loves these arrangements, but they're sometimes the only way that a charter school can find any space anywhere. What the district's new policy sort of proposes to do, you know, according to the charter advocates, their complaint is that it basically uses this request against them. And there are a number of other facilities issues that sort of charter advocates say are being used against their applications and could be, they're not envisioned by this compromise of AB 1505. It's sort of this additional issue that's been tacked on that charter school advocates are saying, you're using this beyond your powers to try and shut our schools down, block new schools from opening, and potentially even endanger existing schools to continue to operate. It's not all about co-locations. A lot of it is about facilities issues. They have a broad list of grievances about it, but a lot of the biggest ones come back to facilities, which has been a contentious issue for a long time.
Has LAUSD chimed in on this at all?
Yeah, so here's the thing about AB 1505 is that what it does is that it allows school districts to judge a charter school's application based on whether or not opening up a new school in a neighborhood would be good for that neighborhood. And so what the district is saying is that it's sort of hard to divorce the issue of facilities from whether or not something is good for a neighborhood. Because if you don't think co-locations are good for the existing district-run school, and I think a lot of folks on the school board, for example, would take that view, it's hard to sort of separate the issue to facilities from your consideration of whether or not this school would be good for a community. But I think broadly, you know, because this is about more than just facilities, what they're saying is that what the district would say is that charter schools' problems with LAUSD's policy aren't problems with LAUSD. It's not that LAUSD is overstepping. They just have a problem with the way that the state law came out, and that they're trying to sort of basically refight the fight that they were trying to have in Sacramento and just fight it on the local school board level. And so that their gripe is really with state lawmakers and how that all played out and not with LAUSD, which is just trying to carry out this new state law as it was written.
That's KPCC's education reporter, Kyle Stokes. Kyle, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
All right, moving on. Sports leagues such as MLB and the NBA are pushing ahead with their respective seasons despite the pandemic still gripping the nation. While there have been different degrees of success, at the end of it, we are talking about professional athletes there. Now, that brings us to student athletes. Today, the Pac-12 Conference postponed all fall sports, including football, with the hope of playing in the spring. Now, that means that for now, schools like USC and UCLA will not be able to renew their sports rivalries. For more on what led up to the decision, we have with us Kenneth Shropshire, CEO of the Global Sport Institute and Distinguished Professor of Global Sport at Arizona State University. Kenneth, welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Now, the Big Ten Conference, that includes schools like Ohio State, Michigan, Penn State, they made their announcement first earlier today, followed by the Pac-12's decision about an hour ago. Kenneth, what do you think was the primary reason they did this?
Student health and safety and those that they are around. And I think it was a difficult decision, and one that was countered by the economics of it all. The cancellations is going to cost, some projections, and even in communities, of $80 to $100 million per school. So it's going to be pretty incredible. We haven't really calculated in, though, when the season does happen, if it happens in the spring, what will be recouped at that time.
When you say student health and safety, I'm wondering if we could add liability resulting from student health and safety issues, because that's a part of it, right? I mean, if something horrible happens to one college athlete and a death results, Kenneth, I mean, that's a liability issue that I don't think anybody wants to deal with.
No, I think, and it really is disheartening when you hear people say, we could have had them all signed. Waivers for liability and that sort of thing. I mean, in the end, we are talking about the health and safety of these, in the case of football, these young men. And the idea that we don't do everything we can to protect them, even where they might not want to protect themselves, even though where they may not realize the danger they're in. And if, I'm not playing a doctor on the radio or otherwise, the harm they can bring to their family or others that they come in contact with, if in fact their youthful fitness protects them.
Now, football has historically been the only real guaranteed moneymaker in college sports. That money helps to fund other programs, such as women's sports. But without fall football, Kenneth, you think there's a danger that those sports will be victims of, say, budget limitations when the time is to maybe try and bring those sports back?
In some senses, it's going to be a reality check of how much revenue from football was used for these other sports. And overall, as those of us who look at this have been thinking about the whole reset of sport overall in college and beyond, what is it that we are really going to be able to carry forward? And are there some things that we should make some changes on going forward? So definitely there's an economic impact. I think a lot of what we will see in the reset is some contemplation of the role of sport in college and what we really need, what we should emphasize. If we do bring football back in the spring, will there be people in the stands? Will that be the moment that college says, well, we can come this far, but we can't have people in? So the revenue will still be impacted. So yes, there will definitely be an impact, not just on football, but the sports beyond. And the decisions on budgeting that these universities have to make in terms of whatever impact they have on tuition from having to shift to online courses and not having the large number of international students and all these other elements that come into play.
Campus life, sports are part of campus life.
Yeah, it's going to be a tremendous transition, just as we have felt in the rest of our lives.
Kenneth, what are the chances that all the fall sports will be able to make it back in January? Because then everything that was postponed might crash into all of the spring sports. I can't imagine all of that happening all at once.
Well, a scheduling nightmare, overlap overall, overlap in facilities, overlap in terms of classes and trying to have prioritize having sporting events that don't conflict with classes and the like. So it's going to be a very difficult task, but this is what schedulers do. The good thing about football is it's once a week, but think about, too, the practice facilities. I mean, is football going to share the space with the sports that generally have that space in the spring to themselves? So very difficult to contemplate how that's going to be done.
Kenneth Shropshire is CEO of the Global Sport Institute and Distinguished Professor of Global Sport at Arizona State University. Kenneth, thank you very much.
Thank you. Take care.
All right, once again, the big news of the day, California Senator Kamala Harris has been chosen by Joe Biden to be his running mate. All things considered, with Nick Roman is going to start early today at 3:00 to cover this story. It's going to be covered all night long here on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up next, though, overhauling a school district in a pandemic, all while committing to anti-racism. The district on the beach next to LAUSD is giving it a try. Find out which one and why they're doing it on Take 2. That's coming up in 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and streaming at kpcc.org. I'm Amy Martinez. Educators have a lot on their plate as they start the new year, both in how they'll teach and in what they'll prioritize while teaching. Following this summer of protests calling out systemic racism, one superintendent of a local school district issued a commitment to anti-racism. Dr. Ben Drotti is the superintendent of the Santa Monica Malibu Unified School District, where the student population is over 10,000 students. He grew up in Pasadena after his family immigrated here from Uganda, and he felt moved to make a statement on how he'd lead the district to integrate anti-racism into the curriculum following the death of George Floyd.
To me, all of this really, I feel confident that if we're going to get out of this, it's going to be the children that gets us out of this. And as a school district, we have our kids from kindergarten or preschool all the way up to age 18. And there it's a captive audience. They spend more time with us than anywhere else. So what an awesome opportunity to allow the students to really understand the world and look at equity and civil rights and everything in America through a true lens and make their own determination after they actually see the information.
Now, on that note, Superintendent, because there's a sentence in your message that I wanted to bring up, and I'm going to quote your words here. We bear a great responsibility as educators for shaping society, as we have the unique privilege of educating our youth as they are forming their values and worldview. Superintendent, what if a parent comes up to you and says, thank you, but I, as a parent, will be responsible for my child's values and worldview? What do you say to that?
I hope the parents see that we're going to approach this thing through true history. We're not going to make anything up. It's just going to be very transparent about what we're learning about. But we're not going to hide anything. The issue in America is that you want to hide the ugliness of what happened in the U.S. and you only want to promote the good. But you got to talk about the ugly and the good so you have a true picture of what's taking place. So I have to respect every parent that has this view, mm-hmm. but this is our curriculum. Every student can come bring their perspective on it. So if somebody has a counter argument, they just have to provide information and data, and we all learn from it. The whole idea behind this is the more diverse the class you have, the better the learning should take place, because you're going to introduce concepts in which students bring their background knowledge, what they know about the world, and bring it into the discussion. How powerful is that? So if you have somebody of Iranian descent, Armenian descent, Jewish descent, African descent or European descent, and they have a perspective about a particular issue, think about the learning that's going to take place there.
No,
I'm excited. I'm sorry, I'm getting excited.
I can hear it. I can hear it in your voice. Absolutely. Yeah. I wanted to ask if a commitment to anti-racism also has any kind of influence or impact on the kind of hiring you do for new teachers and administrators, and also in training for the existing ones.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We have an entire professional learning plan dedicated towards this. I hired a coordinator to help us implement what we call the social justice standards into core curriculum. And let me kind of explain what that is. There are some standards of behavior that came from teaching tolerance that are around, one, being able to recognize understanding self with respect to living in America. For example, as an African-American, do I really understand myself and my own identity in America as an African-American? And am I able to understand others in their identity in that terms? And then am I able to recognize injustice? And so those are standards that are often taught in ethnic studies classes like Chicano studies or Armenian studies or woman studies, LGBTQ studies. These studies that teach about those issues, if you extrapolate those standards out, you can overlay that in any general curriculum like English, social science, math, biology, because as you teach that curriculum, you're looking at it through a social justice lens at that point. Say you're doing math and you want to do a scattergram, and that's a big piece of math. Were you going to study the impact of gentrification in LA and why that is and who's benefiting, who's not? You can do a scattergram around the different types of liquor stores or Whole Foods that exist. Where do they exist, and why is it concentrated in this area and not in that area? Imagine learning math through that type of lens. It's powerful. So as we hire people, we look at what they know about these issues and we bring them on board.
We're talking to Dr. Ben Drotty, superintendent of the Santa Monica Malibu Unified School District. Now, one of the other things you write about is the importance of being anti-racist. I'm wondering, how has your district maybe fallen short before now?
We have a huge achievement gap. To me, we have an achievement gap. We have acceptance rates in honors classes, AP classes. All those things are all byproducts of a system that's not supportive of everyone. So we have to undo those things. The most challenging thing, I think, in all of this, not just here in America and addressing this, is we always target the most explicit forms of racism. When somebody calls somebody a name, or somebody's flying a racist flag or doing something that's obvious.
Yeah, the visceral ones, yeah.
But you don't take on the system that produces the outcomes that are biased by nature. you know, so.
And those are generally more widespread and more hurtful historically and down the road.
Absolutely. You know, when you look at a healthcare system and who's dying, who's not, and there's a system that allows that to occur, but we all partake in it, including myself as an African. We all partake in the system that produces these outcomes. What I'm trying to do is to dig into that through curriculum, right? I want you to learn history. I want you to learn math. I want you to learn physics. But let's take on issues that seem to cause results that are biased, you know? So that way, when you start voting, when you start talking about healthcare, and when you start talking about education, when you start talking about these systems, the prison system, the justice system, when you start voting on some of these things, you're more aware from the social justice lens. And to me, that's when we have arrived. The easy thing is to identify the person that is being racist, visibly racist. That's easy. The hardest part is us being able to look at ourselves and see how we partake in a system that's marginalizing others.
And do you think that maybe learning the history of systemic racism will improve the achievement gap with your students? Like, will it help students of color academically to be able to know how far this goes back and how it works?
Absolutely. Because with the African-American Latino community, there's the systems that are created to support one group, whether we do unintentionally, but we're all just kind of breathing this whole air in that as an African-American young man or whatnot, when you start looking at this and believing it and you start believing that whole thing, it shapes your outlook on yourself and what you're capable of doing, right? So we have to psychologically undo those things. You can be a doctor, but there's always been doctors that have been African-American and sometimes not being promoted. You can be a scientist. Yeah, have you guys seen that show, Hidden Figures? I don't know if you.
Yeah.
If you think about the power of those ladies and what they did there, that's not anywhere in any of these textbooks, right? Yeah. It's not anywhere. No one's reading about this. But how many of those things occur throughout the world that shapes a person's view of themselves? And if you have women out here that have never seen a woman doctor, or have never seen an engineer, or all of a sudden you have this view of who you can be.
Yeah, and those women were as responsible putting Americans into spaces as anyone else was.
Absolutely. Yeah. And while their hands were tied behind their backs, you know, so that's how curriculum can shape people and build values and perspectives on self and others.
Dr. Bendrati is a superintendent of the Santa Monica Malibu Unified School District. Doctor, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You remember when we used to go to restaurants, like inside the restaurants, and sit down, order a meal, talk to people, and then the server would come, take your order? Those good old days, remember that? Well, remember there used to be little letter grades outside, depending on how clean that restaurant was? Well, what if there was a letter grade system that told you how much a restaurant complies with coronavirus safety protocols? That idea is coming up next when Take Two continues. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. I'm Amy Martinez. Restaurant critics traditionally rate the quality and taste of food, but an Orange County restaurant critic has launched a new system that rates how well restaurants comply with coronavirus safety protocols. It's called the COVID Comfort Rating System, and he grades Orange County restaurants on a scale of A through F, depending on a set of criteria. Restaurant critic for the Orange County Register, Brad A. Johnson, launched the new system, and he joins us now. Brad, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so let's start with the inspiration behind the COVID comfort rating system. What prompted you to create and launch this?
Well, what inspired me to do this was I left town for a few days, and I saw the difference between the Orange County response and the response everywhere else. I took a little road trip to the Central Coast, and what I saw in Los Angeles and Santa Barbara and San Luis Obispo and Paso Robles and everywhere along the way was shocking. And it was shocking because all the restaurants and wineries that I visited were really taking the pandemic seriously. You know, every business that I went to had a sign on the door that said, no mask, no service. When I dined, the tables were distanced far apart. The servers were constantly sanitizing or washing their hands, putting on new gloves every time they came out of the kitchen. And so there were all these extra protocols in place that, as someone who dines out all the time, I wasn't used to seeing, and I certainly wasn't seeing here in Orange County. And the funny thing is, it wasn't jarring to see this. It didn't make me feel like the pandemic was more dangerous, but rather the opposite. It made me feel safe. It made me feel reassured.
Yeah. And as a restaurant critic, Brad, I mean, your job is to help people make decisions on where they go eat. And this whole experience, dining out, has really changed. That means your job has changed, right?
I've always believed that dining out is about so much more than just the food. I've always, you know, written about the whole experience of dining out, and that includes the atmosphere, the service, the hospitality, the way a restaurant makes you feel. And over the course of the pandemic, of course, that mission has taken on just a whole new meaning, a whole new dimension.
All right, so I'm dying to know what goes into the letter grade. So can you break down the criteria you use to grade restaurants in Orange County?
First, just to be clear, these ratings are based on my own personal experience, my observations at restaurants around Orange County, and how they're responding to the guidelines, the new protocols that were established by the Orange County Health Agency, the California Health Agency, and the CDC. So these new criteria for safe reopening of restaurants include, you know, all kinds of things, from masks required for staff, masks for customers when they're not seated at a table, elevated sanitation protocols for cleaning tables and chairs and high-touch surfaces, and, you know, having hand sanitizer available, not just for the staff, but for customers, the way tables are distanced. You know, even things like temperature checks and gloves and, you know, in certain situations, and outdoor dining versus indoor dining.
So it sounds like there's a very long checklist that you're looking at when you walk into a place or you walk getting near a place.
It is. And look, to be clear, there's no one size fits all solution to this, obviously. You know, gloves are not a panacea. Masks, you know, by themselves are not, you know, going to fix everything. And so I'm just looking at the totality of it.
We're talking to Brad A. Johnson, restaurant critic for the Orange County Register, about his new COVID comfort rating system. So, all right, your system gives restaurants a letter grade. Can you walk us through what warrants an A, B, C, D, and beyond?
An A is really just covering, you know, pretty much everything on the list, but also just going above and beyond that. It's a place that just makes you feel really comfortable and really safe. And on the opposite end of that spectrum would be an F. I think we all know what an F stands for. and in this instance, it's really, you know, these are the restaurants that are just ignoring or blatantly disregarding, you know, any of the recommended protocols, at least as is evident to the dining customer. The ones that are dining indoors, the ones that are, you know, not wearing masks.
Brett, I got to admit, if one of your restaurants that you've looked at gets a C or below, I am not going there. I know C is not a failing grade, but I wouldn't go.
Well, and that's your decision, you know, and that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to give people information to help you make your own decision about what feels safe to you. These ratings are informational. Some people will feel comfortable going to an A, B, or C, or maybe just an A and B. Other people might feel comfortable all the way down to a D. And, you know, some people might actually be drawn to the restaurants that are getting an F.
Actually, you know what? There are a couple of taco places, Brad, where if they got a C, I would probably go. The tacos are that good. I would actually go for right. those tacos. I won't mention specifically where they are, but well, you know, right. I'll have to see. Now, how is Orange County faring so far? Can you give us some examples of restaurants that are waiting well or not so good?
On average, I would say Orange County is getting a C and a D. But there are a number of restaurants that are really stepping it up. Oliver's Osteria is a great little Italian restaurant down in Laguna Beach, and they have set up a outdoor dining room on the parking lot with tents, and they have, you know, a barricade set up. And in order to get past the barricade, you have to get your temperature taken, sanitize your hands, and then wear a mask. You know, just all throughout the meal, everything, the attention to detail is pretty good. And I gave them a beat. There's another little sushi restaurant in Newport Beach. It's the only one so far that's gotten an A.
Oh, really?
Because they're only seating about 6 people a night, you know. So they're kind of in a different league. And then there's a restaurant in Santa Ana called Benchmark, where it was really fascinating to watch the waiters, because if they were delivering a drink from the bar, or if they were delivering food to a table, or if they were removing food or old dishes from a table, every single time that they would come or go from the table with a dish, they would sanitize their hands. And you just haven't seen that anywhere else to that degree. So they were really on top of it there, but they got a, you know, they got a B.
Mm-hmm. What about the Fs? I want to hear about an F grade.
Well, ARC in Costa Mesa, which has long been one of my favorite restaurants in Orange County, but they are not wearing masks. The host doesn't wear a mask. The owners don't wear masks. The chefs don't wear masks. They seat indoors. They seat at the kitchen counter, which is a bar counter that wraps around the kitchen where everything is being prepared. There's no special attention to the seating distancing. The chairs are set up exactly the way they were before the pandemic. It just suggests to me that they think this whole thing is a hoax. Nice. And so to me, that's an F, you know, and some people might be okay with that.
Red, you mentioned how the goal is for people to make good decisions about where they go eat. You're not trying to police anything. It's your opinion. It's what you think. It's your own criteria. But what would you say? Because here's the thing. I mean, we're going through a time where restaurants are hanging on by their fingertips to survive. A lot of the restaurants all over California. If someone were to say to you, Brad, hey, you know what? This rating system of yours, it might hurt businesses. It might put people out of business.
I'm not here to police the restaurants, you know, and I fully appreciate that everybody is struggling right now, particularly restaurant workers. And that's in part why I'm doing this. I don't want restaurants to be shut down again. I don't want restaurants to be the source of the next wave of infections. We're all in this together. And if this industry is going to survive, we have to keep the restaurant workers safe. We have to keep the customers safe, or we're never going to get back to normal.
Brad A. Johnson is a restaurant critic for the Orange County Register. Brad, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, big news today. Kamala Harris, California's junior senator, is Joe Biden's pick for vice president. We're going to be covering this story all afternoon long here on KPCC. All Things Considered with Nick Roman starts early today in just a few minutes, right at 3 o'clock. So make sure you tune in. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take 2 is back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.